accession number 19670, reel 3.
For Daniel Reel 3, have you any specific memories of Mountbatten?
Yes, I have. They come rather later because, as I can tell you, I was on his staff eventually. And indeed, upstairs, you'll find I've got my signed autograph photograph from him when I left with his thanks. At that stage, I mean, in 1943-44, the period when the authorities decided that the rather sad story I think it's called the First Arakan Campaign under General Irwin, which was happening when I was up in the north, was over, and Mountbatten was appointed Supreme Commander for Southeast Asia. I can't remember just when he was appointed, quite honestly, but it must have been some time in 44. Oh, might have been late 43, but the impact on us of this change, which took place just about when I was going from the 69th to the 60th Regiment, and we were concentrating in the Bombay area, and with a whole corps, it must have been, I think it was 33, learning this game of they were all learning as a big unit, the combined operations. Mountbatten's first intention being to do something like that on the shores of Burma rather than wait to come down through the mountains and the north. I saw him then on one occasion. He came round and actually addressed our unit with others and sort of, you know, told us to get our tails up, as it were, and stop being miserable, and everything was going to improve. And the war in Europe would be going, because that was before June 44. Now, it so happened, because the Japanese broke through, and I'm trying to think when they did, when the Japanese made their big offensive, and I've forgotten what the code name from it could have been, Delhi or something like that. But almost, it seemed, unexpectedly, we heard about the Japanese breaking through, leaving, as it were, the confines of Burma and coming into India through Manipur, our troops being besieged in a place called Kohima. Now, at that stage, my regiment, which was in a place called Galunchi, which was somewhere 40 or 50 miles from Pune, in the Western Ghats, I think it's called, that part of Bombay province, we were told we weren't required anymore. The number of anti-aircraft, we had a whole anti-aircraft brigade, two light regiments, two heavy regiments, and supporting services and so forth. And we were told it was all not going to be required. One heavy regiment, one light regiment would be disbanded, and that would be mine, the light one. And this was rather alarming, because what would happen to us? Now, I had a good colonel, I said, a man called Jenkins, and he seemed to like me, and indeed I had become a sort of staff officer by then. I was, there was a thing called a Royal Marine Anti-Aircraft Brigade, and it had disappeared. The Royal Marine Brigadier and all his staff had disappeared overnight. What we were not to know was they'd gone back to Europe, and they would be used for D-Day. They'd been wanted. So we had to improvise a brigade headquarters to fill the place of the absent Royal Marine Brigade, and I was made staff captain of that brigade. My colonel thought I was that sort of a chap, you know, had got that sort of a mind. So I was a staff captain. I had a terrible brigadier who I could tell lovely tales of, but he really was a dugout Indian brigadier. Never commanded anti-aircraft troops in his life, knew nothing about it. And then we had a major and myself and a doctor. I think that was the whole brigade staff. It only lasted about 3 weeks. And then I was told I wasn't going back to my regiment because there wouldn't be a regiment to go to. And my colonel was being whisked off for other duties. I think he turned up somewhere in Burma later, but I never saw him again. And he said to me, well, you don't want to be an infantry reinforcement, do you? Go and find yourself a job in Delhi. So I was given a nice chit by him and told to go and see somebody in Delhi. And I went and have a holiday because the brigade wasn't wanted and anymore, so there was no staff captain's job. And I wasn't wanted to command my troop because that was being broken up anyway. So off I went to Delhi and installed myself in the hotel for a fortnight or somewhere, and then went round looking for a job. This could have been peacetime, couldn't it? And I went to GHQ India and knocked on the door, as it were, and chap said, oh, lovely job for you. Brigade intelligence officer on the Northwest Frontier. And I said, but I don't speak any languages for that. And they said, well, of course, you'll have to go to England first for a year to learn push to or something, and then come back. I said, well, that's ridiculous. I'm not a regular officer. I'm a wartime officer. So they said, well, we haven't got a job. So I walked across the road into Southeast Asia Command headquarters, where young Mountbatten was setting up his headquarters, and said, have you got a job for an artillery captain? And they said, well, have a look. We've certainly got a job for captains here, if you're free. And I said, I'm free. And there I found my friend Rafe Hogg, whom I mentioned, who had been in Ealing Studios. And he said, oh, we're forming a unit to combat cameramen. Mountbatten wants to picture the war as he fights it. And we have lots of cine cameramen. And we're looking for a chap who knows his stuff to keep us all in order and to write our G1098s out, which is the sort of, you know, table of equipment, and to be the adjutant and keep chaps in order and do everything like that. You'd be just the chap. Come and see my colonel and he might like you. And I went to see the colonel, and he was a Burma Rifles chap who'd been the ADC to the governor of Burma. And he said, oh, just the chap. So there I found myself a job, adjutant, quartermaster, captain. After all, I'd done both jobs. I'd been quartermaster captain in one regiment, and I knew about adjutanting. I'd been assistant, as it were, to our adjutant time to time, and I'd been a staff captain in a brigade for 3 weeks. And so I found myself forming this unit, getting chaps, writing to Britain and saying, can I have some cameramen, please, and so on. And there I was in Delhi for about a couple of months or so, and in the middle of which D-Day took place. And one day Mountbatten summoned us all and said, we've landed on the coast of France. And 3 weeks later I had a letter from my sister-in-law saying, your brother's missing, believed dead. And that had all happened in June 1944. The Japanese had been contained at Kohima. The regiment, my regiment, had been broken up, but of course we were part of 2nd Division at that stage, and they'd come in from the north, as you know. And there was I with this funny outfit in Delhi. About a fortnight later, I was in Calcutta again, looking for accommodation, looking for where we could train cameramen in Calcutta. So I went to a place called Tolly Gunge, which is often known as Tollywood, where East India Film Studios, and we commandeered half the film studio for training. And then I found some quarters to live in through the people at Barrackpore who looked after the army down there. All this was sort of improvisation. I was armed with a little bit of paper which said I was a senior officer of Mountbatten's headquarters, opened every door. And before long, there I was again in sort of running this setup and arranging for training. There was a gentleman appeared who seemed to know a lot about photography and was a Royal Army Ordnance Corps captain, and he said, I'll take charge of the training. And there we were, and I thought, well, this is funny business. I'll never see any fighting at all in my life. I mean, real fighting. But that seems to be it. Then along came a new colonel, instead of Mr. Colonel Hodgkinson, my Burma Rifle Colonel suddenly disappeared, a young man appeared called Knight, and said, I want an officer in charge of operations. Back you go to the war, and you plunk yourself alongside the army commander, that's Slim, and control all our cameramen throughout the theatre. That was 18 of them. That's what I had to do. Then I found myself in a light aircraft going hither and yon, usually with a cameraman, and being told that the battle had developed and so, and saying to this chap, get to the battle and photograph it. And we had a wonderful system of red bags which developed. I can't remember how we did it, but red bag meant either film going to or it meant film coming from, and it was all marked in some way, and all aircraft captains were supposed to handle this properly and get it to Candy, of all places, Candy, where we had some laboratories. This is an extraordinary story, really, and nobody believes it anymore, but it's true.
Do you mean Candy and Ceylon?
Candy and Ceylon, which is where my man established his headquarters. And we got our film supply from there, and we sent the film back there to be developed, too. You can't believe it, but it's true. And I found myself, first of all, called Officer in Charge of Operations of Southeast Asia Command Film Unit British, based with the Army headquarters at Camilla in Bengal, but very rapidly at Imphal. Once the Japanese had cleared away from Kohima, we went to Imphal. And there I was at Imphal alongside General Slim, or some, doing all sorts of jobs. I mean, I can't quite remember just how I managed to do them, because I must have been fed, and I must have been watered, and I must have been taken in transport where I wanted to go. And I think my little yellow badge, which I've still got upstairs, my little yellow sort of card, simply said I was a VVIP. A VIP, not a VVIP, a very important person, not a very, very important person. I actually had those distinctions, VIP. And I was given transport, any form of transport, if I wished it, if there was transport available. And I simply flashed this everywhere and went wherever I wanted. And so there I was. I came in at the tail end of the Kohima battle and went down the road with the troops which came down from the north, and I was there when we put up the monument which said, first use the famous Burma Star thing, you know, when you go home and tell them of us and say, for your tomorrow we gave our today. And I first saw that put up on a wooden cross in the main part of Kohima, in the shattered, almost still shattered Kohima. And then I rushed around, and some stage or other I was told I was no longer officer in charge of operations for the whole of the 14th Army, for the SEAC film unit. I was only captain, remember. But I was now officer in charge of A Group. And A Group, as far as I could see, consisted... We got 18 cameramen sent out to us from Europe. The 18 cameramen we split up, and six was A, six were A, and six were B, and six was C. And I had the six that were A, and we looked after 33rd Corps. And the six which were C went up to the Northern Combat Area Command with 36th Division with a fellow officer called Green, who was in charge of that lot. And then the other six went down to the south, to the Arakan, and they were Rafe Hogg, my friend Rafe Hogg, who got me into this outfit. He was the officer in charge of Operation B. I was A. And then I had to look after the whole of the 33rd Corps, in theory, try to cover all the divisions, which were moving by that time, rapidly, pushing down from the hills and down into the Burma Plain. So I crossed the Irrawaddy three times with 20th Division, with 2nd Division, and with 5th Division. In a matter of 3 weeks, I went from one to the other with two cameramen, and somehow managed to negotiate through the brigades and the divisions getting film to them, cine film. I had a still camera myself and took still pictures when I could. I wasn't very good at it. It's still not a very good camera, but never mind. I had a still camera, which was my own. And we covered, and then in the whole course of that time, two people turned up, one from Government British and one from British Movie Tone. I think, I can't remember their names, but they were distinguished fellows. But they had long-range telephoto lenses. They didn't go too near. But my people, we didn't have any telephoto lenses, and we had a funny old camera, name I forget, but it was a clockwork thing, the Cine camera, pretty dreadful. And they were told to get as near as they could, because they couldn't, they had no telephoto lenses. So I went, across myself with one of them on these three river crossings, two of which were opposed, the last of which, one of which at Alagappa, I think it was, we had the last attack from the Japanese Air Force, which was quite frightening. And I was pretty well close up in everything that happened. Mainly the big battle for me was the Mandalay battle, which was what, February, March 45, when I had a jeep somewhere and a driver, and somehow I caught up with him occasionally, or he caught up with me. It was a lot of time I was light aircraft, and then I just hopped on anything and said, look, can I come along with you? Sometimes with the camera, and so I went on the odd tank and the odd lorry and the odd, you know, and simply got as near as we could and took what we could. What made was terribly difficult was the fact, I always felt, you know, I really shouldn't be here because I have no real part in the battle. Am I going to get in the way? Sometimes I actually did a job. I mean, because I had three pips on my shoulder, somebody major would say to me, look, if you're going that way, can you do that? And so I found myself temporarily, I won't say in command, but giving command and being obeyed. Sometimes I found myself actually, picking up a rifle and thinking, well, at this particular point, I might need it. I never actually needed it in any great way, but I was with the Marquess of Dufferin and Arva when he was killed. Somewhere around about that battle for Mandalay, I met him. He was my own age, and he was in another special unit, which was psychological warfare unit. He was a captain in that. And he said, oh, you might find this interesting. We'll go along, because he had one of these broadcasting apparatuses. And we went, we had some Japanese dug in to some strong point. We'd moved on well past them, and we were trying to get these chaps to come out and say, look, you're all surrounded and you've no hope. And so he was wriggling forward with his apparatus to say this in Japanese, you see, just ahead of me. And I was trying to photograph this. It would be interesting. And the Japanese reacted rather strongly, and the Marquess of Dufferin Arva, unfortunately, poor chap, was killed with a Japanese mortar fire. All I could offer for that was a sort of photograph, which I believe I saw it, but it was of no value at all, because, I mean, it simply showed a sort of puff of smoke, as it were. It didn't mean anything. You couldn't say, behind this puff of smoke, the Marquess of Dufferin Arva had been killed. It was that sort of a game, and then I was with Reese one day, General Reese, who was a wonderful fella, Commander 5-Div. Now, Reese was knee-high to a grasshopper. He was known as Foopy, which I think means little. But he preferred to be known as Die. But he always wore a bright red band. He always dressed like a Gurkha. He wore a Gurkha hat rather than anything else, and he always had a huge red scarf and made himself as prominent as possible so his chaps could see him, you see. So he was rather easy for snipers, and we used to say to him, you know, do you think it's a good idea? But he and I, in the Mandalay battle, I'd teamed up, you know, with the second jeep, as it were, his jeep ahead and jeep behind with his ADC and me, and a cameraman, of course. And then we injudiciously got too near, and we all had to leap into a trench. This was in the middle of the battle. And he couldn't even get to his radio set. That was, he could only make sign. And we did, every time we tried to put our head up, we put it down quickly. And this lasted for about 3 hours, I remember, this caper. Eventually, some unit went round the other way and got the Japanese, that Japanese strong point. But that was a sort of great day. That was the near Mandalay. And then I was at Mandalay when we brought the 5-5s up, my old regiment. And not my old regiment, my old regiment in the sense of Royal Artillery, but not my personal regiment. And we battered away at the walls all day. And I've got a photograph upstairs, I think, from the... and I know it's my photograph because it was on the United Services Journal. And it shows the 5-5s battering the wall at Fort Dufferin. And in the foreground is a cameraman taking a picture. Now, that was my cameraman. And I took, still a cameraman, a chap called Bob Watson. He took a picture of it. And I took a picture behind. And so he's in my picture. And since it's the one with him in, I know it's my picture. That's how I know it. But that was a great time. Of course, we battered away at the walls, you may remember. And, or you may know. And made 17 holes, I believe, in that great wall of Fort Dufferin, but still couldn't get in. So Rees had this idea. He'd been a young staff officer in Mandalay in an early stage in his life, and he knew there were underground conduits somewhere you could get through that way. And he was all going to do that, get into Fort Dufferin that way. And we did. God, he found the way in, and we were still... And then... just as the boys were about to do it, through one of the gaps came a chap with a white flag, and he was an Anglo-Burman, and he said, "I've come to tell you the Japanese are gone. They've left Fort Dufferin." So we never had actually to take Fort Dufferin by an assault. And that was the Mandalay battle, and of course that was one of the turning point in a symbolic way. I mean, these things were captured with symbolic turning point. And I was lucky I was at that one. And then I was at the Arva Bridge, which was the great bridge we were talking about earlier, over the Irrawaddy, the only bridge over the Irrawaddy, which we'd blown up in 1942 on leaving, and which the Japanese could only use they couldn't use it for a vehicle crossing, they could use it by putting up a sort of temporary... rickety bamboo things. They could use it for a physical crossing, but they couldn't use it for... But it was important to get it back, and that was the Arva Bridge. And I was with General Moti Dyer, who was the brigadier commanding 268 Independent Brigade, and he said one day in the camp where we were one morning, he said, "Oh, I think the Japanese gone from the southern end, let's have a go." And we rushed off, about three jeep loads of us, and got to the bridge and then walked across it. I remember going down this sort of rickety old ladder thing down to the riverbed level and then coming up the other side where it had broken off. And then getting to the southern end, and we hauled up the Indian flag, not the flag of, not the Union Jack, but the flag of India, which was a Union Jack with a thing in the middle, I think, that wheel thing, which symbolises India. But we'd haul up the Indian flag, and then we heard a rattle of armoured cars and thing. We knew it wasn't the Japanese. And along came the Dorsets, who had captured Arva in 1828 or something, when we drove out Thibaw. And the grandson of the chap who'd captured it then wanted to say he'd captured the Arva Bridge, and he was very cross. When he found Brigadier Moti Dyer and other people on the southern bank, and we said, "Hi, good morning." And he was a bit disconcerted. And I said to some officer, it was David Livingston, I presume. And he looked at me and he said, "Something in Burmese." And I said, "Sorry, old chap, I don't speak Burmese." He said, "Oh, I thought you looked like a bloody Burman." I'd cut my head almost to the scalp there, my hair to the scalp, and I got so yellow with mepocrine, I could easily have been taken for Burmese. And I said, "Oh, I thought you were Aung San's interpreter." I said, "Well, that's a nice thing to say." Now, he's just died chap, and I found that he was the president of the local Burma Star around here. I did actually to meet him, and I was telling this story, and he said I was the officer he met. So we'd met before. Nice fellow. An officer of the Dorsets, an infantry officer of the Dorsets. So that was a great thing, the Armour Bridge. I go nattering on forever. You better tell me if you'd like anything
Please
else.
Please do.
Well?
Please do.
Well, and then I did, you may remember, may know, the two great hooks were. The 33rd Corps came down from the north, as it were, and we had those three divisions, 5, 5, 20, and 2, British 2 Division. The British 2 Division had sort of gone over the river, and I'd gone over with them, and they hooked back, and they were, the Dorsets were part of them, but they were rather cross because Rees and 5 Division captured Mandalay and Arva, and they'd had it firmly in their sights, because the British 2 Division means an old regular division, it still exists today. And they were mildly cross. I mean, we all had, you know, a tremendous spirit of competition. Great thing Mountbatten did was he got this all going, so it was, you know, rather like league football or something. The 2 Division do this, what can you do, kind of thing. All this spirit had come back. We knew we were on the winning, we felt it all, you know, very early, and we were pushing through. Now, the big deception they did was to... The biggest base in Burma was Mike Tiller. Mike Tiller, which is a railway thing in central Burma, and had 7 airfields. Mind you, poor old Japanese had almost nothing left to put on their 7 airfields, but it was their big base. And it was so far behind the lines, as it were, if you look at the map, that they thought that was... And that would be, I wouldn't say sacrosanct, but it would be a bit like, you know, if they got us at Camilla. But they Slim produced a deception plan, which was to pretend that he was keen on going on from Mandalay, pushing south down the line of the Irrawaddy, as it were, towards Rangoon. And they poised all their troops to resist this. And in fact, he did a sort of hook across the Irrawaddy, where the Irrawaddy goes south, hooking from the west across the Irrawaddy, and then going straight east to Mike Tiller, where apparently it looked as though we were all going to go south. And I didn't get involved in the Mike Tiller thing, but what I got when I was came down from the north with the troops coming away from Mandalay area, and we then held this ground sort of north of the Great Crossing, which I think is a place called Nyongu, which is close to Pagan, and Pagan is the old capital of old historic Burma, the place with the 2,000 pagodas. And I remember very well being there and coming down there and then sort of establishing my little camp, because by this time I was running a press camp. I had about 30 Indian troops under my command, 30 or 20 troops and 10 non-combatant cooks, bottle washers and God knows what, with a Gurkha sergeant major, not a very, you know, not physically able to keep up with the regular Gurks, but a very good chap, marvellous chap. And then I had sort of 3 old lorries, 3 old 3-tonners and a 1,500 weight, and a couple of jeeps or so, and then I rushed around where I could, and I this sort of train, this was my Q outfit,